And then you were asking about whether you were nervous before the big five. I can tell you, the night before, each of the big five was having nightmares about the thing chasing me.
Really?
Yeah. Each one in turn, yeah. I used to have to take a sleeping pill to try and sleep. Yeah. You'll read about it in my books.
Hello and welcome to the Wild Dispatch. I'm Robin and I'm back with more skills and stories from the wild. We have another great show for you today. Another man who hails from South Africa. His name is Dr. Adrian de Villiers, but he also goes by many names. Perhaps the most notorious is Dr. Death. But despite this ominous title, the Doc, as many of us know him, he's been patiently sharing friendly nuggets of bow hunting wisdom with me for a few years now, but I'm definitely not alone. He's written 4 books and over 1,000 magazine articles about bow hunting in South Africa and the rest of the world. I'd say without doubt, though, the thing he is most famous for is his bow hunting adventures back in the 1990s. He was the first South African to successfully harvest the Big Five with nothing but a bow and arrow. But he also chased a bunch of big, scary, dangerous buffalo in multiple places across the rest of the world as well. He's been chased many, many times, and there are quite a few stories of that in this episode. So, unsurprisingly, he has many, many tales to tell. Thanks again to Dr. Adrian de Villiers for being such an open book, and thank you to everyone tuning in for another episode. Every review, share, and like, and all those good things is appreciated. It absolutely makes my week. It also motivates me to go and chase down even more great guests like the Doc, if I can find him hiding in the bushes. But it's time for me to stop waffling, and let's get on with the show. Welcome to the Wild Dispatch.
Thank you.
I'm excited to have you here, man.
Good.
So you've reached like legendary status in the bow hunting community, both here in Africa, but also over in the US as well. But before we go into like the stories of those moments that gave you that fame, I would love to kind of go back briefly to kind of the beginning and learn kind of where this obsession with hunting and bow hunting began. What I'm kind of curious is about, like, who taught the master some tricks?
Okay, well, let me start at the beginning. I came from a very poor family, so I could only really start hunting once I managed to earn an income. Mm. So I had a single mother who looked after me, and she managed to put me through medical school.
Wow.
She convinced me when I opened my eye that I was going to become a doctor, so I never really chose it. It wasn't a choice, my mother made it for me, because her whole family were all doctors. And the reason why she didn't do medicine, but she became an anatomy professor, was because she got pregnant with me when she was at medical school, and then she bailed out then. So, cut a long story short, I qualified in 72 as a doctor, and I went in 76 to Spain for 6 months. And to keep in touch with South Africa, I used to listen to the BBC in English at 11:30 every night.
Okay.
And in the year 1976, there were riots in Sharpeville, and it sounded like Johannesburg was burning. Yeah. So I came back to Joburg and I bought myself a firearm and I started shooting combat at Guthrie shooting range in Half House. And then I used to go to the CNA and buy American Handgun magazine, and they were talking about hunting, handgun hunting with handguns. So I bought a 6-inch Colt Python, started hunting South Africa's game, and then that was 76 to 79.
And what caliber was that?
All cannabis.
Oh, so that specific revolver,
then,
though?
Yeah, then I was shooting a Colt Python, then a super, Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum. That's why my ears are bad. And then I met J.D. Jones and Larry Kelly from Magnaporting and SSK Industries. And then I used to guard them on handgun hunts here in South Africa. All this. Then I told J.D. Jones I wanted my own caliber. So he made some suggestions and I came up with a caliber called 300 Adrian, and I was hunting with that when Barry Gordon at Sharp Edge in town in Calder Center said I should try bow hunting. And he must have asked me about 10 times over a year, just try. And I said, it'll never work. You're going to wound everything that you shoot. It's the worst idea ever. By then I'd shot a world record white rhino with a pistol and a few buffalo. And so eventually I borrowed a bow, an 80-pound PSC Mach 1 made out of magnesium. And I took a handful of miscellaneous arrows because they didn't really have thousands of variations. So nobody knew, they knew about arrow spine, but I had to learn all that by myself.
Okay.
So the very first weekend I went out with the bow, I went to the same farm that I'd hunted Eland with at 196 yards with a 411 Thompson Contender. And the farmer said to me, are you mad, and you'll never kill anything with a bow. He said, and if you do, you can shoot anything for free. So on that same farm in one weekend, I shot a Kudu at 68 yards, an Impala at 30 yards, and the Blessbok at 20.
With the bow?
With that bow that I borrowed for the weekend. And I never hunted ever again with a gun after that. I decided, this is it, this is for me. Because there was no noise, and I supplied all the energy to kill the animal for myself. And there wasn't this loud, horrible bang.
Yes.
And then I shot a number of animals in herds that didn't even know they were shot, and the herd just carried on grazing. So from that day on, I was hooked, but by then I'd already booked a rhino hunt with a handgun, so I still went on the rhino hunt, but that was then the last animal that I hunted deliberately with a gun. I shot wounded game with a 223 of clients of mine that we were looking following, but I never hunted again with a gun.
I've got a question. So you went with this bow for the weekend to try it out, and you shot like a bunch of animals. Had you practiced much with the bow beforehand?
Oh yes, I did. I practiced. I lived on an 8-acre property where Gallagher State is now. We used to live next to where Gallagher's, where Huntix is. We had the property next door, and it was 8 acres.
Yes.
So I had a huge butt, and I used to practice every day.
Okay.
But because I was using the wrong spine, the wrong heads, I couldn't understand why I could shoot really well at 20 meters and at 30 I was going all over.
Yes.
And it was because the arrow spine was wrong, and I didn't know. I thought I was just bad. But anyway, I got those animals that weekend. The kudu was interesting because we were riding down a road in a thatch grass farm in Boerterville, which is just thatch, and I saw a kudu standing in some black wattle trees, and the farmer didn't hear me knocking on the vehicle, so I jumped off, peeked over the thatch grass, saw the kudu. We didn't have rangefinders in those days. I guessed the range at 34 yards, or shooting yards, and I was shooting fingers, and I had the most god-awful flinch as I released. And I saw my arrow going up to the moon, and it came down and hit it in the heart.
No.
And when I stepped it out, it was 68 yards.
So
because I was looking at a very shallow angle, I couldn't get a distance.
Yes.
So that was me hooked. From then on, I was hooked.
But you say it was like a flinch in your form at the moment that you shot. Like a jerk. Wow, that's unbelievably lucky.
That was what made me do it. That's, and then because I'd already shot Africa's 29 or most of them, I decided to go straight on to shooting the Big Five.
Yes.
And that's where the problem came, because the Nature Conservation weren't giving permits for the dangerous game. So I was involved directly with Nature Conservation, constantly pestering them. And there were two people that were very high up in the bow hunting. One was Nico Pelser, who was running Bushman Safaris, and the other one was Derek van Staden running Palala Safaris.
Okay.
And they were taking dangerous game hunts. So I learned from them. And eventually, Nature Conservation, because they knew of me pestering them all the time and showing them what I'd done already, they said I must come with all the Nature Conservation people to Sakebosch Rand, because IBEF, which is International Bio Education Foundation, they were giving a lecture at Sakebosch Rand for all the Nature Conservation people. And then me and a guy called Jim Morris were invited as well.
Mm.
And all the penetration tests and all the studies that I was doing, photos of elephant skeletons and tests on buffalo femurs with 1,000-grain arrows, I'd been sending to PSE. Pete Shepley was a friend of mine. He was sponsoring me by then. And then Andy Sommer from New Archery Products, he was giving me broadheads, and I was sending him, he was giving me broadheads to test, and I would test them on planks that are soaked in the swimming pool.
Yes.
And I worked out that if you took exactly the same arrow and you just made it heavier and heavier and heavier and heavier, each time it would penetrate more and more, even though the kinetic energy was getting less and less as it got too heavy, it still penetrated more. Now, all those studies are sent to NAP and to Pete Shepley. And when the IBEF lecturers taught us about bow hunting and dangerous game, they were using my slides that I'd sent overseas. And then at the end of the lecture, I think the guy's name was Bob Anderson, but I could be wrong. I said to him, "Those slides that you're using, where did you get them from?" He said, "No, I got them from a friend of his." So I said, "Well, that's interesting, because those are my slides." So then Nature Conservation gave me a permit there and then to hunt the Big Five on my own without a backup if I wanted.
So that
was in the 1990s.
That was your way in.
And then they, IBEF made me a master instructor for IBEF.
Before we get to the Big Five,
mm.
I mean, like, amazing. I mean, if there's ever a way to get like permission, being like the person that they're referencing, it's going to be a quick fire way of doing it. But it's like, in your story, what you said, you obviously been hunting with a pistol and using like handgun ammo for quite some time. Oh, I'm curious, you clearly were practicing with a bow, but you knew what you were doing at that point, shooting like three animals in a weekend straight away. Who was there anyone in your life at the beginning who was teaching you some of the like
Nothing.
Essential skills, or is it all just instinct or like both, like learning from your mistakes?
Nobody, I promise you, even the archery shops, all they would do is give you a bow and they would sell you arrows and they would give you an arrow spine chart. They had no idea about how heavy the arrow should be.
Yes.
I mean, I used a PSE Brute 4, which had a sort of a cone point. We were shooting Zwickies for years and years because we could resharpen them with a file in the bush.
Yeah.
And with a low poundage, like a 30-pound longbow, you can shoot right through a kudu with a Zwicky if you don't need the bone. So we used Zwickies for years and years, but then Andy Sama used to give me Spitfires.
That's
and then
nice
I would
Spitfire.
Say to him, "Look, I'll buy them if you cannot put them into that expensive wrapper and spend all the money putting all the little pieces together, and you can sell me the loose things in a little tiny box, I'll put them together. And I bought 288 Spitfires for R8 each.
Wow.
R8 each, and they're R300 each now. So I used those, and then I got a couple of thousand blades. So I would just replace the blades until I lost them.
Do you have any of those left over?
Yeah, I'm still shooting.
You're still working through those 300? Or how many?
I've still got about 1,000 used blades that are going to be sharpened. And then somewhere along the line, like in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I bought my first game farm. I used to supply all the staff meat with my bow.
Yes.
That's why I've shot so many animals, not because I'm a killer, but because all my staff meat for 40 years was supplied with bow and arrow.
And it's the simplest way to do it, right?
And I had two farms. Well, I had six farms, but only two at the same time. I always used to buy a farm. So I bought it for R10, I would immediately put it on the market for R20. And then if I bought one for R20, I'd put it on the market for R40. And it worked six times. It worked beautifully. And the only time I lost money was now during lockdown, when I desperately wanted to sell my farm because I wasn't getting an income anymore.
Yes.
I was living on my savings and the farm was costing me too much money.
So can I ask, were you in that moment during lockdown, like COVID happening, was it because there were no hunters coming over from the US or people weren't hunting very much during that period?
What happened was when Malema and Cyril Ramaphosa started talking about taking land without compensation, all the weekend farmers like me decided they're not interested in risking it anymore, they're going to sell. So when I was buying farms, there would be maybe 10, 15 farms in the areas that I wanted to buy, and the rest of South Africa, another whole lot. And then as soon as they said that, there were like 5,000 farms for sale in the Transvaal.
Okay.
You couldn't give them away.
So the price just plummeted.
Yeah, so a farm that you should have got 20 million for, you got 5 million for. And you either sold or you just... Then the other thing, when they said that, there was a giant market going on with color variants. So people would buy a little plot of ground, buy one impala, black ram, and put in a whole lot of females. So female impalas were going for large amounts. Wildebeest cows were going for R25,000. Because they were beating golden wildebeest.
Yes, yes.
Then
yes.
Comes along Malema and Ramaphosa. By then I had 90 sable, and I paid $4.5 million for pregnant sable, and I sold my 90 sable for R10,000 each because the market was down to R6,000 for sable. The sable cow was worth R6,000 during lockdown. So I sold 90 sable for 900,000. So sure. That's when I had to bail.
Yes.
Before we could sell a sable and then pay for the food for the farm and the staff for a year. And then it was lovely, I loved it.
Yeah.
But once the market fell out, only the guys that are really established, like Dries Visser and Palala Safaris and Bushman Safaris, they can carry on with American clients.
Yes, as long as you have that flow coming in. So I have a question. We'll come back to the farm stuff because I want to ask more questions about the whole guiding people and farm things. But I'm curious. Actually, I have like a couple of questions.
Let's talk about ethical bioethics for a minute.
Exactly, that's what I was going to ask you.
So what happened was, I realized the minute I started bow hunting that nobody wanted bow hunters on their farm. Nobody. They said, it's a poacher's tool and we're going to shoot stuff and we're never going to tell them. And we're going to walk away. Every time we win something, we're going to walk away and not tell them. So I started an organization called Ethical Bow Hunters, which is this badge here. That logo of the archer.
Yes.
And I registered that Archer logo with SCI, which used to be in Littleton as an education foundation organization, because I was with an RBF instructor. Now, all the people that hunted with our badge were all certified by RBEF, and our club guaranteed that if a bow hunter came there and left a wounded animal there, we would pay for it. We would pay for it.
Really?
And so it never happened, and then people started trusting bow hunting. And then that organization ran for about 30 years, and then Pierre van Wyk, who runs African ABO,
yes,
asked me how I can get ABO certified by IBEF, so as an education foundation organization.
Can I ask, what does ABO stand for?
African Bow Hunter Organization, that's this badge.
Okay, and it was achieving a similar thing as the ethical bow hunters?
Yeah, and he had far more members than I had. I think at some stage we had 16,000 members, but he had more doing ABO. So I said to him, why don't you just take over? I'll shut down RBF, Ethical Bow Hunters. They take over my logo, education logo. And when we get certificates, they all get certificates. They can get a dangerous game certificate or an ordinary game. You write a questionnaire about the current laws about bow hunting, and you shoot 20 shots and you have to get 80%.
So that's part of the achievement, get the approval.
That's part of it. I still do ABO and ethical bow hunting. We still have the competency test. Dexter, no.
I have a question, because you said that there's a certification element where you have to get 80% accuracy on the shots that you take.
Yeah.
Was there any element of education or teaching people about where they need to shoot or that kind of part of things, you know, or how to behave? Like, obviously, don't leave an animal if it's wounded and don't tell anyone. Or, you know.
There is a long questionnaire that goes with it.
Okay.
And then when you shoot your competency on a 3D animal, you don't shoot for the points system, you shoot for kills.
Okay.
So the person that's taking you will direct you on what's a kill and what's not a kill.
So you get educated.
It's not about whether you hit the 11 ring or the 10 ring or the 8 ring.
It's about actual position.
Yeah.
And so I'm guessing those animals were, because with 3D foam targets.
Yeah, they're like the one outside my room.
Yes, right? It's usually a flat side-on or a side-on shot always, isn't it, with those things?
No,
but
it could
quartering
be quartering
shots.
On, it could be quartering away, it could
right.
be through bushes.
Because if you're shooting at an animal quartering,
but
I'm saying this.
The idea is not to trap somebody. The idea is just to see that the guy can shoot.
Yes.
So you give him, he's allowed to take a range. Allowed to take a range and he can take his shot, take his time.
Yeah. As you would in the bush, right? Just wait for the right moment to shoot. So you've kind of been a figurehead in this ethical bow hunters community, and you've done a lot of hunting. And you switched over to bow hunting from handgun hunting. And then from that moment on, you're like, this is it. This is me. I'm a bow hunter. How many different animals or species have you, sort of since that moment, have you been chasing and have hunted?
Well, I've got 85 so far.
85?
Different species.
Different species.
But Archie Nesbitt's got 222.
Wow.
Yeah,
so you're like...
And there's probably another 222 that he hasn't got. So if you look at gazelles of the world and sheep of the world and goats of the world, and there's thousands and thousands of different species that you can get. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Wow. There's got to be a point where... only some of them are worth the adventure to go after, right?
They all are. Every single one is.
Yeah.
I mean, I hunted Ayodhaya sheep in the Glass Mountains in Texas for 10 days.
Did you?
And when I was on the bison hunt, because I got the bison on the first day. And the Barsa, they had sheeps that one over there. The yes. Barsum hunt we did in the day, and then the PH let me go in on my own in these glass mountains in Texas. So it was a town called Marathon. And in the mountain I got mule deer, elk, mountain lions. I could have shot all of those on that hunt, but I didn't have a permit.
Oh, because of the taxes.
So the Ayodhya sheep are exotic, so you don't need a permit for them. But I got a beautiful mule deer that I could have shot. I got a beautiful elk. I got a beautiful the javelina. Javelina I shot, but I couldn't find it.
Javelina are like the tiny furry pigs.
The big tusks.
So were you actually doing, like, for fun, practice stalks? You would just, like, stalk up to the thing and be like, yep, I could have shot you. Or you just could see?
I just, while I was stalking the Barbary sheep, I bumped into the... Because the mule deer have got very long horns.
Mm.
And they lie in a bush called a scrub oak, which only grows this high.
Like about
and
a meter.
And then you've got these giant horns sticking out. You can see them for miles. And then I got distracted trying to get a picture of the mule deer when I walked right 20 yards past the Adelaide sheep. But you're talking about going somewhere. I mean, Archie Nesbitt shot an animal called a taken. It's a cross between an antelope and a goat. It's about the size of a wildebeest and it's very dangerous. The only one ever shot, they live in China,
the
golden taken. I mean, the amount of fun it must have been just to go to China. And the president gave him special permission because bow hunting is not allowed there to go and shoot the golden taken.
Wow. Yeah, that must have been an adventure.
And then you were asking about whether you were nervous before the big five. I can tell you, the night before, each of the big five was having nightmares about the thing chasing me.
Really?
Yeah. Each one in turn, yeah. I used to have to take a sleeping pill to try and sleep. Yeah. You'll read about it in my books.
I have read. Yeah. I think it was the first one, though. I haven't read your first one. But how many books have you written?
Four.
Four books.
Have you not got the first one?
I couldn't get it because it wasn't in print at the time.
I've got samples, yeah.
Okay, well, I have to take that off your hands today. Okay, so you're saying there wasn't one particular of the big five that is most, like, gave you the most nightmares, they all did.
No.
Is the, forgive me if I'm, like, getting this wrong, but the leopard is also in the big five, or is it not in
yeah,
the big
definitely.
Five? It is in the big yeah. five, because tell me about your encounters with leopards and why they're particularly scary.
So, I was lucky, I was planning to shoot a leopard and a lion over a bait.
Okay.
I was planning to shoot them over bait, and then we had on my one farm, the Wild Side, which was my second farm, I had Kim Nichols and Mosh Nichols, PHs from Zimbabwe, baiting leopards on that farm, and Dries Visser also baits on that farm.
Okay.
The world record leopard was from my farm, at SCR number
was it?
One, but Dries Visser shot it with a client there. So. I had leopards on bait and they found me at work and I rushed out for the, because they had one, and that was the last of the big five. I struggled to get the leopard. And then my one friend was at the hut called the Mountain Reebok hut, and his job was to shoot impala, more impala, to keep baiting the leopard.
Yes.
And on my way back from dropping Roy off at the hard, I was walking down a very narrow road with circle boss on the other side, and I saw impala running first all to the left, and then they came from the left and then crossed to the right. And I thought, that's strange, why are they behaving like that? And I got to a marula tree, and it started raining, and when I looked round behind the marula tree, I saw what I thought was a butterfly in a raisin bush. And when I looked carefully at it, I could see it was a rosette. It looked like a moth, actually.
Yes.
In the bush, but it was a leopard sitting with its back to me behind the bush.
With the print.
And I could see one rosette.
Wow.
And there was a small triangle like this of a gap in the rosin bush. And I arranged it, I had a rangefinder then, and it was 26 yards. And I didn't know how far the leopard was behind the bush, so I made sure that I shot through the middle of the triangle with a two-bladed thunderhead. And as I shot, the leopard roared and he did a forward somersault and took off. That's actually that one up there, it was a female. And then I called Roy, I said, you won't believe it, I shot a leopard, walk and stalk. So we went and looked, and there was a drop of blood the size of a 5-cent coin, dark red blood.
Yes.
And a bit of shaved hair. And we found my arrow, and there was nothing on my arrow, nothing.
It was clean.
Clean, there wasn't a mark on it, not blood, nothing. So he said, oh shit, you just nicked it.
Oh.
And we waited, we started walking to the house, and it started raining really hard. By the time we got to the house, we were ankle deep in water. So I thought we're never going to find that leopard now because of the rain.
So the rain is going to wash all the blood away.
Yeah, so that was 12 o'clock on the 11th of April.
But did you think that you, because it sounds like from what you could see, like at the back with a rosette, you thought that you'd made a good shot? Or did you think that you just...
I didn't know where the rosette was. I had no idea what part of it. Could have been its bum,
yes.
Could have been its leg, could have been anything. Anyway, so I had a very good tracking dog, Savage, and he started tracking even though it had rained, and there was a clump of thatch grass folded over, and when I picked it up with the arrow, it was thick with blood underneath. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, we followed, and then we found little bits of meat in the thorn bush, and Marsh Nichols had a shotgun. His son had a 14, which is like a bird shotgun.
Yeah.
Roy had a pain gun, and I had nothing, no bow, and we fell like a winded leopard.
He said, you had your bow with you?
I had my bow with me.
Because you wanted to
I'll never shoot a running leopard before. Anyway, so my dog eventually stood on his hind legs, and he wouldn't go in the bush, and my leopard was dead. And that one blade of the thunderhead had come horizontally and cut it on the left side, and cut a hole in its chest, and its spleen had fallen out, and it was dragging its spleen.
That's what the chance
was. And it was stone dead, and it's got a huge hole, that one, got a huge hole on the other side. That's why we mounted it with the left side to the wall.
Ah, okay.
And then I shot three more walk and stalk after that.
Really?
Yeah, in Zimbabwe and...
Other places,
yeah.
I remember reading your book. You had a close call at one point with a leopard. You were, were you stalking an impala?
No, I was walking along. On that wild side farm, after I shot that leopard, we went on a game drive. It was all mountains. We went on a game drive and we saw 5 leopards on one game drive. That's how many there were.
Wow.
And then one day I was digging out a cactus called Queen of the Night, which is exotic.
Okay.
I was sitting underneath a weeping bourbon tree, digging the roots out to throw it into a thorn bush to kill it.
Oh, because you were getting rid of that?
Getting rid of them, and some bark fell on my head. And I looked up thinking it was a squirrel, and there was a huge leopard lying like 2 meters above me, lying across the branch like this, looking at me. And when I saw it, I got such a fright, I'd like startled him.
Yeah.
Then he saw, he'd seen me. And he turned around nonchalantly and he walked back towards the tree. And I ran to grab my bow. My bow was against the tree. I was like this far from it.
Yeah.
As I got my bow and put on the arrow, it went down the tree. And it went into the long grass. And a female came from the other side of the tree and went down the same place. And all I saw was its bum and its tail doing this. And I was thinking, shouldn't I? And then I didn't shoot because I didn't really have a shot.
Yes.
So I possibly could have shot one that day as well.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That sounds scary though. You must have thought about the fact that that leopard was just watching you. If it hadn't eaten recently.
And then one day I was walking along the river in Zimbabwe and there were only 2 of us on the farm.
Okay.
And I, very early in the morning, or the day before, I shot a giant warthog on the edge of a riverbank. So the next morning I went to the same place to look and see whether there were five or six, if any of them had come back. And out of the corner of my eye I saw some, it looked like somebody was waving a handkerchief. It looked like somebody was waving at me through the bush. But and I turned to the left to look and it was gone. And the sun just started coming out. And so I looked again and I thought it's the guy that I was with earlier. I thought he was pulling my leg.
Like flapping a hanky at you.
So I looked in and I saw a flash again and I said, geez, it's a leopard going between two shadows. And then I saw in which direction he's going and I saw there's a bright green fever tree on the riverbank and I took a range, it was 25 yards. And I drew my bow and I sat on 25 yards, dead still like this. That leopard walked to 25 yards. If he'd looked at me, I wouldn't have shot because he would have attacked me.
Yes.
But he was looking completely the wrong way and I shot. And I dropped him right there and it was 25 yards. So that was one of the other ones.
And he didn't even run?
No, I spied him. And then he saw me and he started dragging himself towards me on his front legs.
Really?
But I was 25 yards away, but not very fast. He was just coming
for you.
Dragging himself, and I shot him again, and he still came. And so I shot him again.
I remember you telling me this before, when we were talking before another time.
Tough boy.
You were saying there was quite a few of the big five, maybe all of them. If one of them is looking at you or is aware of your presence in any capacity, you wouldn't take the shot. Because there's no chance that an arrow is going to kill them before they've stomped you or gored you or killed you completely before they actually die. So that must have been, there must have been frustrating moments where you thought that it was the moment and then suddenly it's like, it like sees you.
Yeah,
and
but
like,
if I hadn't spawned it, what it would have done is jumped in the air and run straight ahead. That's what they do.
They run away.
The minute you hit, every single animal that I've shot, dangerous game, every single one, if they don't know you're there, the minute you hit them, they just run in the direction they're facing. And the Cape buffalo and the water buffalo, they usually run 60, 70 yards and then they spin around and they turn around and they look back to see what happened.
Yes.
So in Australia, what we used to do when I went with my sons, we would shoot the first shot, on perfect shot, and it would run in the floodplains. And then we'd randomly push the sight, the single pin, up to 60 and draw the bow. And invariably they would run almost exactly to 60 and turn around and look up. And then I would aim on the tip of their nose with my second shot and get the second shot. And it almost invariably worked out.
So like a frontal
Not
shot.
Not always, but out of 10, I would say 6 of them would stop around about 60. And then give him a second shot.
That's got to be some presence of mind to be like, all right, change the sight, ready to go. One thing I'm just going to do, is it okay if I just close the sliding door a little bit? Because I'm just getting a little bit of like airplane noise. So, in the research for this mission that you decided to do, well, okay, first of all, why did you suddenly decide to go for the big five with a bow when no one had done it before?
No, the reason was that I'd already shot the plains game with a handgun.
Right.
And I'd already started on the big five with a handgun. So I didn't see any point starting right at the springbok level and going all the way up to the big five. And that if I'd taken longer to do it, I would have ended up paying a hell of a lot more than I did. Because, I mean, in those days I paid 4,000 rand for a hippo, 12,000 rand for a buffalo, 20,000 rand for a lion. My first elephant was 20,000, my rhino was 25,000.
And this is the 90s, eh?
Yeah, that was in the 90s, yeah.
Okay.
So if I'd waited until now, I would have had to pay $250,000 for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was relevant too, because when I first started working, I was only earning 3,400 rand a month.
Mm.
And I paid 3,200 rand for a Rana. The first Rana only cost me 3,200 rand.
So doing
it. And it was a month's salary.
Yeah. Still, it's pretty, yeah.
I mean, and then I sold the horn for 13,500 rand.
Did you?
Yeah, that was like a year, a 10-month salary.
And was that, was around that same time that you did that?
That was 1991.
Wow. So tell me about the, I'm looking up right now and I'm seeing a ton of buffalo and bison.
Seven species of buffalo.
The big five, you achieved the big five. Was it the bison and buffalo that you decided afterwards you were going to chase them? Did that happen?
I thought I must practice when I was, practice on the bison for the buffalo. For the Cape buffalo.
Okay.
Because I heard about how dangerous they are and how hard they are to kill.
In America?
No, so I heard that the Cape buffalo are so hard to kill and their ribs overlap.
Yes.
So I thought, let me practice first on the bison.
But an American bison.
An American bison,
yes.
In Texas. Yeah. And then a water buffalo, the Argentinian water buffalo, like that one next to the bison.
Yes.
I practiced on one of those in South Africa, in a place called Miamo. I found a bull there, and that was number one. That bull was number one for about 20 years in the SCR book for exotics for South Africa. Much bigger ones have been shot now, but in those days there weren't very many.
Yeah.
And that one I shot also.
Which one?
It's a female next to the one, just the horns.
Okay.
Next to this buffalo, that's a female.
Okay.
And then the other big one I had here, I gave to Sean Emerson for his archery range to put up for ornament. A really nice big one.
And how, how many different places? You went to Australia, I read. Like, I read some good stories about you going to Australia to shoot.
I went to Australia three times. I went to Greenland for the musk ox in 2015. I shot 5 Cape buffalo and 26 altogether. I got 4 Banteng. That one, unfortunately, the horns have shrunk completely down from when I shot it.
Mm.
Looks just like a cow, but they're beautiful animals.
Yeah. So do you have any, like, those travels that you did, getting these buffalo and bison?
Did I have any?
Were there any stories or moments from those travels that were either like close calls or things that you really remember? Like, what was the hardest but most satisfying moment in one of those hunts? Or can you think of one of those?
You know, they were pretty much all nice, huh?
Yeah.
The yak, that yak was number one SCR for years.
Yeah.
And the same happened on my Banteng. The Banteng hunt was my third trip to Australia, and I said to the PH that when I come back, I'll only come back if I can get an extra species.
Mm.
So I booked with Graham Williams from Australian Buffalo Hunters, and he couldn't make it, so he sold my hunt to a guy called Joe Wilson, who was a crocodile hunter, and he couldn't make it, so he asked a guy called Robert Tritton to take me, and he was too busy, and fortunately he didn't dump me. He just asked Ruben Cooper, who lived on the Arafura Sea, and he had international backpackers that used to do ecotourism there, and he was an ex-Australian rules football player, and he was well off.
Okay.
And he married a very blonde Irish girl called Dawn. And she ran the camp meticulously. So they flew me and my son Shane from Darwin to a place called Merganella, which you can Google on the map in Australia. It's on the Arafura Sea.
Okay.
And we watched from the air where the closest water was, and we had lighters and mats, you know, fire starters, and we knew that we could survive. Then we went into this little prefab building, checked for water. There was no water.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, we're in trouble here. We're gonna have to survive for a week till they come back next Friday at 10 o'clock to fetch us. Anyway, next minute here comes a brand new white Land Cruiser VX, and it's Ruben Cooper, and he's got this beautiful new Land Cruiser. We didn't even have them yet.
Yeah.
And he took us back to his camp, and he gave us a two-man tent with air mattresses. The food was exquisite. The company was phenomenal. The friendliest, nicest people. Every morning we used to walk in the Kuburg National Park, and then we would carry a 5-litre drum of murky water from the borehole, nothing else. And then at lunchtime, we would shoot like a bush turkey, which is like a guinea fowl, or we'd shoot a wallaby or a baby crocodile, and then we'd make a fire and wrap it in tin foil and then eat that for lunch. So I think I lost about 15 pounds.
How long were you there for?
Yeah, we were there for 10 days.
What time of year was it? Was it like a hot time of year?
No, it's August. It's just after the wet season.
So it's winter.
Yeah, it was autumn.
Okay.
It was the end of winter.
Yeah.
So their rainy season is our summer.
Yes.
And then August is the end of their dry season. So you go there, otherwise it's just swamp. You don't want to go there.
Oh, it's like
swamp.
Just full of moisture.
So you normally ride along the edge of the swamp with the Land Rover. You take a GPS coordinate, and then you walk into straight through in the swamp, this deep in mud, that the buffalo have all peed in. So it's like stinky mud.
Yeah.
And then you get into hard patches, and then you hunt, and then when you're ready to go, you hit the GPS and say, where's the car? And the car's usually pretty close. You've been walking all over the whole day, and then where's the car? We had 3 GPSs, we each had one. And we'd go back to the car and carry back the cape. You know, water buffalo wet cape weighs over 100 pounds.
You had to carry that back in one go.
So one of us would carry the horns over our shoulder, and the other two would carry the cape in the plastic, like dustbin. That was a mission.
A 100 pounds in a dustbin.
No, yeah, it's
a dustbin bag.
You know, in a plastic dustbin.
Oh, actually in the dustbin.
Dustbin. Yeah, we'd get the dustbin, put it in there.
And just carry it through a
swamp. And then when I shot the Banting, we were alone, no pH. So I caped it out beautifully and I salted it beautifully. It was the second night before we were coming back, and I said, whatever you do, do not wash this thing ever. Leave all the salt on until it's hard. Just wrap, fold it up, but don't wash it. And they washed it. And when it came back to South Africa, it was rotten.
Oh.
And there was a guy in Carltonville called Fred Peterson. He bred Banting. And a friend of mine, Alan, shot that skin.
Okay.
In Carltonville. And I asked him if he could give me the skin for my Banting. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a skin on him either.
It would have just had to be a skull or something.
So that was a close one.
So do you travel to the US to hunt as well, right?
I traveled there a lot because as a radiologist, they have a radiological society meeting in Chicago every December for a week, first week of December. And because my practice would pay for me to go to Chicago, I used to book a hunt and then fly from Chicago, say, to Gunnison to go and shoot the yak, and then fly to Idaho and shoot the mountain lion, fly to Texas, shoot the bison, all over, fly to New Mexico and elk hunt. But every time I went there, I didn't have to pay to get to America. I had to only pay the in-between.
That sounds pretty convenient.
That's why it made it easy for me.
Yeah, definitely. So with the bison that you shot in America, at that time, I'm guessing there weren't many people who'd shot one with a bow. Was it hard to convince them to shoot a bison?
No,
as well?
No, not at all. I took my ethical bow hunter's certificate with me, and the Nature Conservation saw the certificate, and he said, sweet, he gave me my permit. And then I bought a camo outfit for $7 at the bottle store. There was a bottle store in Marathon.
Yeah.
I went to the bottle store and I bought the camo outfit and the mask, and off we went. And it was awesome fun, absolutely awesome. That hunt should be on that book called The Way I See It.
I remember reading the story. But didn't you have some close calls with the bison?
Yeah, I did, a lot.
What happened?
Two. Well, the first bison, he said, wasn't big enough. As a trophy, I mustn't shoot it. But he had a Betamax, giant Betamax camera. And we sneaked up on the bison in the little Land Rover with a short wheelbase. And he was like 6'6" with a big white Stetson hat on. And he stood on the back of the Land Rover, on the little backy part, filming me. And he said, I'm going to sneak up. And it was lying down, facing where the house was, where I first saw it. We were sitting having iced tea, first iced tea I ever drank. We saw this bison, and I said, yeah, that one's lovely. He said, no. Anyways, he said, I'm going to sneak up, shoot it with a rubber blunt. He said, and it'll run away. Well, it didn't run away. It ran off to me. So I ran flat out through my bow in a tree and dived through his legs into the back of the bucky. And it hit the back of the bucky as I dived in. And he fell off there with a Betamax camera on top of me. But fortunately, my bow was in the tree. My bow didn't get damaged.
So it was intact.
So the next time I got hold of the next day, we were walking around and we were looking for bison. So it wasn't the first day, it was the second day. And then we found a bison that didn't know we were there. Now, he was wearing blue jeans and leather shoes, cowboy boots, and a white hat. And he wanted to film me with a Betamax camera. I was in full camo and it was quite cold in the morning. So I put two white t-shirts on underneath, and it got hot, so I took the t-shirts out and put them in my pockets because I was getting too hot.
Yes.
And I was sneaking up on the bison through cedar trees. Now a cedar tree grows about 8 foot tall, but it's not nearly big and you can't climb in it. The branches are thin.
Yeah.
And there's a bush called a cat claw, which is like a bad wachabiki.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the yucca candles are also sparky, and that thing called collar. It's a very prickly cactus, and it shrinks up like this when it's dry. And if you bump it, it slaps one of its limbs out like that and hits you with a prickly pear.
Ugh, yeah.
And then the prickly pear sticks in your leg or in your back or in you don't touch them, they're like spring-loaded things. Anyway, so I was sneaking up on the bison, got nice and close, and this idiot he's busy walking next to me with a video camera, and the bison sees him.
With the giant hat and blue jeans.
And spins around and starts coming and then sees me because I'm closer. So I start running, luckily I was still young and fit, ran through the cat claws, and the cat claws pulled the white t-shirts out of my pocket. And the bison attacked my t-shirts in the cat claw and let me go. So after that, I used to walk around with t-shirts in all my pockets. In case another one comes, I'm going to use them for decoys, throw them out.
I've never thought about that before. That's a good idea. Something to just give another target.
Throw your white t-shirt out there.
I believe you like wrote to Fredbear in the past.
Yeah, I've got a letter of Fredbear's.
So that was when you were researching for the Big Five?
Yeah. No, when I wrote a letter and asked him what poundage I would need to kill an elephant. And in the letters in my book,
yes,
he said to me, you won't be able to kill an elephant with a bow. He said, don't even try.
Like, that's at all? He just said flat out,
no chance. He said if you hit the rib, an elephant will never go in, and he's right.
Okay.
Because I've got elephant ribs here, and if you put them sideways, they find you can shoot through them on the flat surface, but they're curved sort of sideways. And if you hit them sideways and the arrow hasn't got a rounded point so it can ricochet off, and it sticks in there, it won't go through and it won't break a rib.
Mm.
Incredibly hard ribs. When you shoot an elephant, you've got an 80-20 chance of missing the rib. But if you hit the rib square on, it won't kill it and it won't go in. And you don't need to run around like a mad thing and go shoot it, because the elephant's got a trunk. He just takes his trunk and he pulls the arrow out and he eats it.
Eats the arrow?
Yeah, he bites it. And so it's not going to, you're not going to have to run around the whole of the sauna trying to find it.
Oh, to track it.
Yeah,
it's like
if the arrow didn't go in, you're not going to kill it.
It's nothing.
And it'll heal. It'll be in 7 days, you won't even know it got shot.
How strange. And so Fred Bear said you can't do it, but you did. You succeeded.
I shot three elephants. There's one of them. So what I did with mine, knowing that they're going to pull an arrow out, I score them with a pipe cutter. So when they grab it with their trunk to pull it out, it breaks off.
Okay, so it's got like a slight weakness for sideways.
You'll see one of my arrows still got score marks on it there.
And how did you... So with the elephant, I remember reading in your book, this is in like 90-something that you...
Yeah, early 90, or 1989, 1990.
Okay. Were you... I remember you writing at some point about the fact that elephants have like a specific thing with their lungs that they won't actually collapse. So like for most animals when you hunt them, if for instance, you know,
puncture their lung, it will collapse.
Like, I mean, I just shot a kudu the other day and it was a little bit of a high shot, but it was double lung, you know, and so then it, you know, it just has no air supply, but that doesn't happen. The lungs collapse and there's no air.
In a normal animal, the lungs are held open because there's a vacuum between the lung and the chest wall.
Okay.
The lungs aren't held open due to positive pressure in the lung. They negative pressure. So there's a potential gap called the pleural space in the lung, between the chest wall and the lung, that's filled with water, with liquid.
Okay.
So if you get an inflammation of the lining called pleurisy, those two linings touch together and you get terrible sharp chest pain, it's called pleurisy.
Mm.
The elephant's got a thick yellow elastic layer holding the lung open. And the reason for that is that they put their trunk sometimes 13 feet down in a riverbed to suck water out underneath the sand.
Do they?
And if they had a lung like ours and the negative pressure could pop one of those little alveoli, which are the little air sacs that look like grapes in the lungs.
Yes.
If those pop, the lungs would collapse and they would die. So they can't, you can't, rhino you can get this much penetration in a hippo and its lung will collapse and then...
Just like 3 inches.
It might not die from it, but it will be restricted and you can hunt it again, get it again.
Yes.
So normally what happens is that one lung will collapse. If the hole where the air comes in, where your broadhead is, happens to have a flap system, like a valve system, every time it breathes in, it sucks air in. And when it breathes out, the air doesn't come out again, so it gets a thing called a tension pneumothorax. Then the lung will push right across the other side and it blocks the normal side and then they'll die.
Okay.
So you can...
Is that on an elephant or is it...
No, an elephant, it can't happen.
Something else.
And I presume the same applies to a whale that goes so deep that it also probably has the same anatomy.
That means that it can't
can't collapse its
lungs. So then what happens if you double lung an elephant?
And you don't hit a blood vessel, nothing will happen. It has to hit the blood vessel.
So it'll be fine, unless it bleeds out.
That's why you need to hit that massive heart.
You have to hit it in the heart.
Yeah, and the heart's as big as this chair.
The chair I'm sat on.
So the legs of the chair, yeah, it's huge. 25 litre, it'll fit in a 25 litre bucket.
Wow. So, did you...
You should aim for the heart. The heart is attached by the aorta to the dorsal spine. So, then it lies on the sternum in the front. And then the Americans always say that their animal's anatomy is different and their vitals are further back than our animals, which is absolute garbage, because every animal, when I did botany, I did comparative anatomy. So now a fish, for example, it's got lungs and the heart sits in the same place in the fish as it does in the mouse and in the elephant. The heart. The only animal where the heart sits in the middle of the body is a crocodile. The crocodile can move its heart and its liver forward and backwards for buoyancy, like a submarine.
Really?
So if it wants to dive, it moves its heart forward and it dives. And it can move its liver and its heart backwards. So its heart sits in the middle of its body.
Yeah.
So when I shot my crocodile, I didn't shoot it behind the shoulder. I shot it through the middle of the body here and I hit it in the heart. And it just bled out.
How interesting.
Yeah. And they swallow rocks as well, because when we put our CT scanner in at Garden City Clinic, we used to x-ray eagles and that for the zoo to show their brains and their eyes and their pituitary fossa.
Mm.
And we'd x-ray crocodiles, body scan crocodiles to show their anatomy of their lungs. So they've got huge air sacs in their lungs that aren't little pockets like ours, where they can store large volumes of air when they dive. And then they also smell like these round river rocks for like ballast. You know, like a diver does?
Yeah, for like a weight belt.
To get the buoyancy right. And then they move their organs backwards and forwards to do whatever they want to do.
So I'm curious. I mean, it's obviously, I know what the answer is, but you were in the medical industry for a long time. How did that inform? I mean, you seem to have like a very detailed understanding of anatomy of animals. How did that affect the choices that you made when you were looking at animals and thinking about shot placement? Was it different?
I knew that every animal would have a normal anatomy. The way the anatomy was inside it.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how big the ribs were on an elephant and how strong they were. So a friend of mine was in Nasna and he took a photograph of an elephant there for me and he gave me the photo when he came back.
From the forest there?
Yeah, from Nasna. And he showed me that he put a matchbox, the old matchbox, between the ribs. That's the space between the ribs, the matchbox.
Yes.
And also with the elephant, luckily, when it breathes in and out, you can see the line where the gap is. And the same with the rhino. You can see their ribs and you can see a dip where the gap is.
The space so between
if you're
the
20 yards away, you can definitely shoot a gap like that, you know what I mean, with a bow.
Yeah. So let's talk about pigs for a second.
Pigs?
Yeah, because... I noticed this when we were hunting together last year. We were talking about all kinds of things and then the subject moved on to pigs and you had this light in your eyes of excitement.
I still love shooting pigs.
And are pigs like the tastiest animals to eat as well? Of all the things?
No, they're nice to eat.
Yeah.
But if you cook them nicely and you cook them properly and you bake them in the oven, they're absolutely awesome to eat. But I just like hunting them because they're such big, stocky animals. They're nice targets. And because they've got such short legs, they don't see that well. If they had long legs like an impala, you would struggle to kill a pig.
Yes.
That's their big weakness. And people think they can't see, they can see bloody well.
It's low.
They look, they can see very well.
And so we're talking about, I'm just thinking people who maybe aren't from, so in South Africa, people just refer to warthogs as pigs. But you're talking about warthogs, right? And that, for me as well, like I've hunted quite a few of them now, and I do agree, like they have so much character as well. Like their little legs and their big, just like tank-like bodies. I was hunting in a farm over in the Eastern Cape a couple of days ago and found a big pig with big, you know, big tusks.
I saw the picture.
Oh, you saw it, did Fred send it to you? Or did I? No, maybe I sent it to you.
You sent it, yeah. There's a, that was a 14 or 15.
Oh, huge thing. And so I can definitely understand the excitement. I don't know why, but like when you see a pig like that, and actually I've seen them on two separate times doing the same behavior. So I hope that no one gets to him first, but I'd love to try and cross paths.
Yeah, me and pigs, I love them because I used to shoot nine every weekend on my farm, and I was farming for 45 years.
Yes.
So, I mean, on the wild side farm,
yes,
we had like 5,000 hectares. The farm was about 2,300, but it was in the mountain, so you can double that.
Yes.
Because you're getting the surface area is not included, it's just the flat surface.
So it's like grading increases,
yeah,
the amount
of land. The next door neighbor had arranged with the previous owner to put the game fence 100 meters in from the border. The border was the Mamba River, and we only had like 1 kilometer of the river, and he had 5 kilometers of the river.
Okay.
And the reason being that there was a dam on the property in the 1 kilometer, so the farmer that had it before me used the dam, he locked the dam. And then what happened was the dam washed away because the river was called the Mamba because the floods happened, and then it would wash. It wasn't called because of the snakes, it was called because it was so quick when it rained, it would flood, flash flood.
Okay.
So now
I
had 100 hectares of my farm, outside my farm, on a 4,000 hectare cattle farm. And they used to overgraze their farm, and all the pigs used to come and eat on that 100 hectares of mine.
Mm.
And if we went in the morning with 8 cars, by 10 o'clock, we all have a pig by 10 o'clock. 8 cars, walk and stalk, all walk and stalk.
Wow.
So there was a windy river, all bamboo, choked with bamboo. In some places, a kilometer wide, some places 10 meters wide, some places nothing. And we cut got a couple of guys together with pangas, and we cut a tunnel through the bamboo on the edge of the bamboo, and we made each segment 30 yards. And then we would turn it, and then another 30.
So like a channel?
Every segment was 30 yards.
So you're basically building like a tunnel?
We didn't have rangefinder, so we would walk along the tunnel and then see something in the next segment and know that the end where it turned again was 30, so we didn't have to guess. We could see, okay, it's 30 or it's 20 or...
Yes.
And so we would shoot pigs in there. I mean, by 10 o'clock we wouldn't even be 2 k's up the 5 k, and we'd have got 8 or 10 pigs already, or bushbuck.
Bushbuck?
That's where we got all these big bushbuck, like that one, those ones.
And
so I had number 1, 3, and 5 in the book at one stage.
Really?
Yeah.
And what's the difference between I've not even seen a bushbuck yet. I'm thinking of bush pig.
Bush pig, yeah.
Yeah, so
that one, there's a bush pig to the left on the water.
Okay, yes. And
it's
so
completely different.
And they behave differently, do they?
They usually only walk around at night, but on our farm they walked around all day, every day, in that same river. We shot hundreds of them there.
Yeah.
Hundreds. I think I had that farm for about 25 years.
and that meat is going like that feeding meat, everyone.
That meat I used to keep, it's red meat.
The bush pig?
Bush pig's red meat and the warthog's white meat, and the bush pig's way better.
Is it?
Yeah, way better.
How do you like to cook it?
What?
How do you like to make the food with it? Is it like on
anything,
a barbecue
anything,
or?
Chips, chops I mean, and spit fry, roast, anything, but it's better than the warthog.
I quite like warthog meat,
it's
I have
bright
to say.
Red meat, it's like ostrich meat, it's so bright red.
So you have like very fond memories of hunting on your farms. What was it that motivated you to get a game farm in the first place?
God forbid my wife sees this video. This video.
Okay.
So what happened was, when I was, as I said, in 76, I was handgun hunting. So when I met my wife, was in 76. And her father used to invite me to Messina to come and handgun hunt in Messina. And then we'd often go to Messina, and I'd go hunting with the father and the brother. And then when we got married in 1981, and then by 84 the kids arrived.
Yes.
And then Grandpa didn't want to hunt anymore. He wanted to stay with the grandkids, play with the grandkids. And then my first wife, which is my current wife, she said to me, "No, you have to stop hunting now. We have to." I said, no. When we got married, the rules were, you were satisfied with what I was doing when we got married. I'm not stopping hunting. If I told my wife I was going to go on a week hunt, in 3 weeks' time or 6 weeks' time, I'd have a long face for 6 weeks, because she'd be sitting with the kids sometimes.
Yes.
So my friend Roy Smith said to me, and I always wanted a farm, but he said to me, "You know what, unless you buy a game farm and tell the wife the ball's broke and you have to go to the farm, she's gonna whinge all the time when you want to go to the farm." So luckily, one some or other time, the receiver revenue overtaxed me for a few years, and he sent me back quite a nice amount of money, and I bought my first farm for 156K.
Wow.
It was 1,500 hectares on the Tambuti River.
What area is that in?
That's north of Malkrafier.
Okay.
It's Fallwater area.
So it's north of here?
North,
like,
yeah. It's
north of Joburg.
North of Tobazambi as well.
Okay.
So then I would just say to Colleen, and then Colleen and I used to, we didn't have a house there, we used to go camp there for the weekend, and it was awesome. And then when we went to visit Grandpa and he wanted to play with the kids, I used to go and hunt in Messina. So it was great fun. And then from that time on, I just bought a farm, fixed it up, sold it, got a better one, fixed it up, sold it, got a better one. Each time we got a better farm. And then Colleen started like going there. And once the kids wanted to go to the farm, it was easy then.
Yeah.
And then I used to get a lot of leave. So I would have like a week's leave a month. And then I couldn't sit around at home. I'd go to the farm for a week. So for the last 20 years, I've spent a week a month at the farm at least. So
wow, yeah.
That's a lot of exposure to hunting.
Yeah, it's a lot of experience.
And I started giving walk and stalk courses years ago. I would charge 4,000 Rand for a 4-day course. You get 50% off the first animals you shoot, walk and stalk. And then I would take 4 people a weekend for 4 days. Did that for years and years.
Yeah.
And only one guy came on the course and he didn't get a shot in that 4 days. Only one.
Really?
And I felt bad. He was the only one guy I never got it. Everybody else got an animal.
And did you enjoy, like, so you're kind of like being an instructor, but also you were like PHing, like,
I was a PH from 93 until about 2 years ago.
And did you enjoy guiding people? And
yeah, I loved it.
And
I realized that most people can't pull the trigger.
In what way do you mean?
They take too long. They haven't set their mind when they get this. When I tell them there's a pig at 25, they must just draw their bow and shoot.
Yes.
They like dither a bit. And then they say it's my fault because I'm putting pressure on them. And I say, but do you want me to help you? I'll go to the animal close by, now you must pull the trigger.
So I have to say, it's funny hearing this side of the story, but first of all, I have to kind of thank you, and this sounds indirect, but thank you for teaching me a bunch of things about hunting from your books and other things, but also through Fred Hammer, who you hunted with for a decade, and you taught him a ton of things, and now he has gone on and taught me a bunch of the things that you taught him.
And he also agitated about pulling the trigger.
And so this is the funny thing, is because now when I hunt with Fred and we become very good friends, when we're close and I'm like really close to a warthog or an animal, there's this moment that he comes in and he starts whispering in my ear, pull the fucking trigger. Just shoot the fucking thing. And it's funny now.
Did he also say to you, look, when we're walking, if I see something and I say, draw your bow, just draw your bow. Don't ask me, what did you see? Where is it? What is it? Just draw your fucking bow. Did he also say that?
He says exactly that to me.
I said, stay behind me, draw your bow, but don't draw it towards my back like some people have done. Turn around and the axe drawing his bow at my back.
Oh. That must have been a bit of a fright.
Yeah, so my son did that to me when he was 10 with a bloody 70-pound bow, a 700-gram arrow in his wiki. I got him a warthog and he was drawing his bow and I fucking ran away. Chased the pig away. I said, don't draw your bow towards my back. If you have an AD, I'm going to be dead.
In your book also, that you do a lot of hunts with your kids. Do you have any good stories about like things that teaching them to hunt or passing on your information to them, or like things you remember, like maybe when you went to Australia together, or you know, was it fun teaching them to hunt when they were young?
It was actually more fun to watch my son walk and stalk and kill a buffalo on his own than for me to go and shoot another buffalo. I used to love watching him doing exactly what I told him to do and to wait. It was awesome, I loved it. Yeah. And they did everything perfectly. We used to walk around all day with a Swiki broadhead, a spare extra one. And when we saw an anthill in Australia, there's millions of anthills. Mm. Every couple of hours I'd say to him, shoot that anthill at 60 or shoot that anthill at 50, pick a spot. And then he'd practice, and then by the time we got a buffalo, he was so confident that his bow was shooting well that he wouldn't hesitate.
Yeah.
In Australia, when I took Ryan, I took him first, and then Shane, and then Ryan again. We would find a buffalo walking along, a lone bull, and we'd run. If the wind was right, we'd run. I'd drag him along behind me and we'd run literally closer than from here to the door.
What's that, like 4 meters?
4 meters to the back of the buffalo. And then I'd say, draw your bow. And then I'd jump on my all fours and I would run flat out on my all fours this way around the side of the buffalo, making pig noises, like as loud as I could. And then the buffalo would see me and spin broadside and look at me. And then I'd see my son over there drawing, shoot it in the heart from like 15 yards. And it was lovely, we loved it. And then unfortunately the PH had a really bad camera that year. The year before he had quite a good camera video. And we had good, nice videos, but that year he had like a really crap quality camera.
Yeah.
And we didn't get any of those nice shots of me doing that with the pigs.
Yeah.
So that was great fun.
I've heard of this trick before though, like pretending to be a pig in the bush
You can ask Fred.
I've seen him do it.
I took Fred on my last farm. We went to a place called the Donga, which was an old dam that dried out. And then there was a dry riverbed, and we sneaked up on our stomachs to a herd of gemsbok. And there was a huge gemsbok bull. And it was 51 yards away, but it wasn't standing nicely. So I said to him, I'm going to start digging and making a noise like a pig, and that gemsbok's going to turn around and you must shoot him. I started digging in the sandbank because we couldn't get closer where we were, there was no cover.
But yes.
We got at 51, he was okay with the 51. That was long ago when Jake was still young, and he's 14 now. So then I started digging and making noises, and the gemsbok came closer to have a look, and then Fred shot the gemsbok. And then Jake found it, he was still a puppy, he found it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he learned that trick from me as well.
Yeah. It's all getting passed down. Beforehand, we were talking about you being a PH and guiding people. Is there any other moments or funny moments or things where you had like difficult clients or people were learning really well from the things you were teaching them? Was there anything like that that kind of springs to mind?
Now, as I said, the biggest problem I had with people is not finishing quick enough.
Yes.
When the opportunity arose. And I had a guy called Chad Wenzel who was beaten to death by his one of his staff member with a ball pen hammer. He owned Sportec cars, and he used to modify my cars for me.
Wow.
I used to have Porsches and R8s, and he modified my R8 for me. We were big buddies, and he was a bow hunter.
Mm.
And I took him bow hunting on my farm. And he hadn't walked and stalked before. He shot really well up to about 60, 70 meters, very well. And the bow tech, he was shooting bow tech in those days. And I said to him, if I get you a shot, I'm going to tell you, draw your bow, because he had multiple pins, so he didn't have to change his sight.
Yes.
And we in the thicket, in this acacia thicket, and I come out 40 yards from a beautiful wildebeest, but his head in the bush, and he can't see us at all. Come around the corner, and I pull him back. I said, 40 yards, 40 yards, draw your bow, draw your bow. I said, it's 40 yards. So I look at him with the, binoculars, and I'm watching, like 30 seconds, nothing's happening. I turn around, I said, Chad, what the hell are you doing? And he hasn't even, I said, put the fucking arrow on your bow and draw your bow. It's got its head behind the bush, 40 yards. And he still hasn't, and I look back at the thing and nothing happened. I turn around and he's standing there looking at his bow and he's saying to me, I wonder if I should use the orange pin or the red pin. I said, I don't know which pin is 40. Use the fucking 40 yard pin and shoot it. As he draws his bow, the wildebeest starts walking forward.
Okay.
So now he's behind the bush that his head was behind. So I run up to the bush. Now we're 20 yards. So I said, draw your bow, it's 20 yards. He draws his bow and the blessbok comes around the corner. And the blessbok's at 40. The blessbok snorts, they both look up. So now he's like deciding, must he shoot that one? The blessbok was clearer in an open, more open area, but the wildebeest was huge. So he decided he's going to shoot the blessbok. So I said to him, it's 40, and he shot over it, and they ran away. And they ran flat out to 90 yards, and they stopped. And the wildebeest was like almost 90 degree quartering away, but looking back. There was an 8-inch gap between its right hip and its right shoulder, and I said, this is how you do it. And I stuck a 1,000-grain arrow in between that right hip at 91 yards into the heart. I said, that's how you do it. And then,
what did he say?
And he didn't get anything that day. He lost that chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, know when to take the moment and take it.
But yes, it was such a nice shot at 40 as well. And I had another client when we were walking for hours, it felt like hours. I can't remember his name, I didn't know him well. And we were walking in the miserable place where there were lots of sort of weedy-like plants, and I thought, ugh, this place is horrible. We must all get out of here and go somewhere. And I looked up and there was a wildebeest standing broadside, like 20 yards away. And I said, 20 yards, shoot it, 20 yards. And he was quick. Just drew and he shot, got it perfectly. It was awesome. If it had been thing, the thing would have seen us, because they eat and then they look up. And we were too close to hide.
Yeah.
And it was like huge broadside, lovely, and he shot it perfectly. It was awesome. And then that thing walked like a few yards and fell over, and the rest of them just stood there. And I said to him, you want to shoot another one?
Did he?
And he didn't know. Didn't.
He's like, I've had enough, thanks.
I can tell you a funny story about Vince. He works at Archer's Edge.
Okay.
I used to be sponsored for Biotech Bows from Reg, but we had a fallout. And he comes to the farm, and he's in the hard, he shoots a wildebeest, but he shoots it with a carbon arrow, a very light arrow.
Okay.
It gets really bad penetration, we can't find it. It bleeds for a while, we don't find it. So I asked him, what's he using? And he showed me, and I said, oh no, that's no good, you need a proper arrow, we're going to have to resight your bow. So I give him, I don't know if he had a Zwicky or if I gave him a Zwicky. We filled up his arrow with some salt.
Okay, for the weight, yeah.
Got it nice and heavy, put on the Zwicky, raised the sharp, practiced at 20 yards or something, and I put him back in the same hard. And the wildebeest, two wildebeest bulls came in. And he was so used to his bad arrows not penetrating, he shot the one wildebeest right through the second one.
No.
And he ended up having to pay for three. And so I call him Vince, two wildebeest, and met Ian Squirt with the skin.
What's the translation of that? Wait, that's Ian, two wildebeest shot with one arrow shot.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
The famous statement in the far on world is two wildebeest met Ian Squirt with the skin.
Is it?
There's a place called Twee Buffels met Een Squirt Doodgeskiet Fontein, where somebody shot two buffalo with one shot. Fountain. Wow. So it's like Olifant's Fontein or Hardebeest Fontein.
Yes. So do you mind if we, if there's any other stories that pop in your mind at any moment, I would love to hear them because I absolutely love them. I'd love to talk a bit about like the technology. The bows, you know, the other gear that you've kind of been involved in helping to create. I mean, one thing as well is that we didn't even cover this, like, in your quest to shoot the big five, you ended up using a bow that was, like, insane in its power, and also, I think it was quite heavy, actually, in weight as well, just because you were helping to develop the new technology, right? But, like, what poundage bow were you shooting when you were shooting at these big animals?
Okay, so what happened was, PSE started sponsoring me a PSE Mac 1.
Yes.
And then the Mac 1 was made out of a magnesium, cast magnesium rather.
Yeah.
And when I put it on 80 pounds, I shoot it for 3 months, and then the magnesium would crystallize in the handle, would start cracking, you'd get these fractures.
Like metal fatigue.
Right where my hand was. It would start fracturing. And then just before I hunt, I would go practice at home, and when I shot, the whole arrow, the bow would break in half and fall to pieces.
Like as you drew?
It would either break when I drew, and then the top piece would hit me and hurt me badly, and the bottom piece would hit me on the leg. So it was dangerous. It was horrible.
Yeah.
So I machined a piece of T4 aluminium. A friend of mine was an engineer. And he helped me machine a copy of a PSE riser. You know, but what I did was, I measured the where the hinge of the limb pocket was. So where the limb pocket was to the on the Mac one, I copied that exactly.
Yes.
And I made a hinge, and then instead of an Allen key, I put a stainless steel rod in, a long rod with a 13 bolt.
Okay.
So if I wanted to work on the bow, I could let the bow down completely in the bush. I didn't need a bow. I didn't have a bow press.
Yes, okay.
That was my other invention, my one invention. Then I put my hand on the riser and I copied my hand and I machined the riser with a Black & Decker sander. I sanded it clip, fit my hand perfectly. And then I built in a short overdraw into the actual in the riser. And I had a drop away arrow rest in the riser. So it wasn't a separate entity.
It wasn't bolted on.
There were brass bushings in the back of the riser. I've got a photo of it. I gave it to Tom Miranda because he wanted to take my current Bowtech bow for his trophy room in America. And I gave him that bow as well for a historical reason. So because the riser cost me 5,000 rand, the aluminium, I thought nobody ever going to machine a piece of aluminium, so I didn't patent my idea.
Oh.
I gave the idea to PSC. I showed them how I did it.
Yeah.
And PSC made the Mac 8 or the Mac 6 out of machined aluminium. It didn't look anything like what I did, but the idea was from me.
Making a different material.
Yeah. So I didn't patent the idea.
Do you regret that?
Yeah, and the drop away was incorporated in the bow, in the arrow rest, in the actual bow.
That's
I've got photos of it all.
Yeah,
of
what I'd love to see some.
I'll go get them quickly.
Okay.
And then, so I gave him the idea, and then I said to him, I need stronger limbs. So he would make me 90-pound limbs, and then I'd say, no, stronger. He'd make me 100, and then I would, because my bow was a copy of a Mac 1, I could take all those limbs and just put stronger and stronger limbs on. So I said, keep bringing them. So eventually he gave me a set of 165 pounds. So nobody could pull it. I couldn't pull it. So I could pull it three times on 130, and I would practice on 110 or 115. And then when I hunted, I would set it up for 130. And then just shoot one or two shots, that's all I needed.
Yeah.
And my sons could pull them, they were 18 by then, they could pull the bows.
The 130 pound.
The 120 they could pull. I don't know if they ever tried to pull the 130. And one other friend of mine, Roy Smith, could pull my bow. Nobody else could pull my bows. And then, obviously, I had custom strings that I made myself.
Oh, did you?
Super thick ones. You know, I used to make them myself.
And then
they came out with their Mac 5, Mac 6 was all machined. And then the quality was exceptional.
Yes.
And those are the ones that I had the heavy limbs on.
Okay, cool.
So there's pictures of them on my poster.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to, if you don't mind, I'd love to take a picture of that and
share
so people can see. The question in my mind is, arrow technology has also improved a lot now, but like how on earth, if you're shooting a bow that powerful, how on earth, I mean, you're talking about heavy arrows, but how on earth do you make an arrow stiff enough as well?
I used to do is take the arrow that I shoot the Big Five with was on the table.
Which
the
one?
Black one.
This one?
The black one, yeah, that's it. So that's a 1,000 gram arrow. And this thunderhead was engraved by the factory. This thunderhead was engraved by Andy Simon, so I could advertise it for them. You see, it's the only one in the world that's got that engraved.
It says thunderhead on it.
So this is a 1,000, this is a 2419 inside a 2512 arrow.
Oh, so it's two aluminium arrows.
Two aluminium arrows inside each other. And then we were using an overdraw shelf at one stage. And I would cut them shorter for ordinary game. 26
so that it's stiffer. That's what the overdraw was for.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is what I killed all of those animals with. And these blades we made out of a Stanley knife. I was scared that the vented blades would break, but they never did. So we took the Stanley knife and a carpet cutting knife.
Yes.
And we cut these blades out of there. We'd grind them out with a grinder. And that I had fixed blades because they didn't have fixed blades, which they came up with later. And these things were razor sharp. They're really, really sharp. But this was the weakness, the chisel point.
Yes.
And now you don't use a chisel point anymore. That's why those are my newer invention ones. That arrow there, you can pick it up. That's also 1,000 grains. And if you look at the broadhead, you'll see that the broadhead fits all the way down the arrow. There's no ferrule. So this broadhead, it's got a spiral on it. And look how beautifully that goes down the arrow. So now we make this much longer. So you can put it in, and when you decide what weight you want, you just cut off a piece.
Okay.
As you go along.
And you glue that in, do you?
Yeah, and then this is this hot glued in here. And this is these are my signature arrows.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Dare, dangerous game.
With, you can keep that for present if you want it.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah, you won't get these anymore. We don't make them anymore. They were too different. They're too expensive to make.
Well, thank you very much.
But I've shot buffalo with these. They whistle through them.
Yeah, at 150 as well. A 150 spine.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Let me feel this. Yeah, that's stiff. I shoot 200s for my bow because I have a very long draw, 33-inch, 75 pounds.
Those are two. I use 250s and 150s.
Sure.
And everybody's under this misconception that you need to have your spine needs to be correct for your bow poundage, but I shoot way overspined arrows, I always have.
Yeah.
I mean, those arrows are shooting on an 80-pound bow, and they were double arrows, and they shot absolutely perfect.
Shoot great. So it's better to be overspined than underspined.
No.
Because underspined is going to go
all over the place.
Okay. So, there's probably obviously a connection, but like you're shooting these enormously powerful bows, and having these adventures, shooting these huge...
Only for the big farm.
Exactly, though. Yeah. You're shooting quite a lot of
and then people
big
say
and the buffalo as well, hey?
Sorry?
And the buffalo and the bison too. You're shooting big, heavy dwarf bows there.
The bison, yeah, I was busy building up to the bison.
Okay.
But when I went for my lion hunt, I was already shooting heavy bow. And then people say, but you don't need it for the lion. But it was shooting so beautifully.
Yeah.
It was shooting like a dart.
Mm.
And I had a great let off on my bow, so I only really had to pull it. I could literally hold it for ages, so the fact that it was a heavy bow didn't bother me at full draw. It only bothered me to draw it. So when I was practicing, I could only pull it 3 times.
Yeah.
And I couldn't pull it. I did weight off and I'd start again.
Do you think, you actually mentioned this, or you hinted at this to me before in another conversation, shooting these really heavy bows, you now have some issues with like your shoulders.
Yeah, definitely.
Like arthritis in your shoulders.
Yeah, and riding enduro for so many years.
You think that was the cause?
I think the bow is more, because
the bow is more.
When you're at full draw, your humerus is touching on your glenoid in exactly the same place each time. So after all those years, it's not like playing tennis where it's rubbing everywhere.
Yes.
It's on that same spot all the time.
Mm.
I think that's when it starts to wear out.
Interesting. So do you, any regrets for like the pain that you're suffering now?
I can't regret it.
For all the adventures?
If somebody had said to me, you're going to get arthritis, I would have said, so what?
Yeah.
I would have done it. Like my enduro riding, I used to fall a lot with the correct gear. I only really needed one operation in 40 years. Of riding, so all the fun that I had and teaching my kids to ride and going riding in Swakopmund on the dunes and riding snowmobiles I rode snowmobiles like a champion because it was like a motor, like off-road.
Yeah.
In Idaho, chasing mountain lions on the snowmobile. It was like a walk in the park. They were all worried I wouldn't be able to do it.
But it was just the same.
Yeah. So I would like to have had less arthritis, but I can't go back now.
No.
It's too late now. No. But I would say, nobody needs to, nowadays with these bows that are so efficient, with the correct equipment, you don't need to shoot 100-pound bows anymore.
Oh. Yeah.
Gary Bogner shot, last year he shot 6 buffalo with 7 arrows using a Hoyt Ventum on 65 pounds with a 950-grain arrow and a razor sharp cut on impact broadhead. He shot 6 buffalo with 7 arrows, so only 1 buffalo needed a second shot.
Wow.
The kinetic energy on these new bows and the efficiency. My 130-pound bow only produced 156 foot-pounds in those days. And now a 100-pound Darton today will give you 128 foot-pounds.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of foot-pounds.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like I shoot a 75-pound bow, and that produces, I think, something like 94.
You only need 85 for an elephant.
So yeah, it must be crazy to see how much things have progressed. So did you? I'm curious. You're talking about heavy arrows and using those for the big game animals. I know at the moment there's a kind of like a lot of thinking around Dr. Ed Ashby and heavy front of center.
He was way behind me with that. I was doing that. So what happened with? As far as I know, I can be corrected. When bow hunting originated just before I started, they were thinking of legalizing plains game. And a guy called Tony Tomkinson was a PH in Natal. Mm. I think Ed Ashby had something to do with it, but I don't know what.
Yeah.
He did studies in nature conservation, shooting animals from hides at fixed distances. And he proved that they would die quickly at a good shot.
Yes.
So that was where we started getting permits to bow hunt because of his work. He was definitely there before me. But they didn't pursue it beyond ordinary game at that stage. I pursued it further because it was in my interest to try and get permission to do that, to hunt the stuff. I wasn't doing it. I was doing it because nobody could tell me. Whoever I asked, they said, I don't know. What do you need to kill a rhino? I don't know. Elephant, I don't know. I said that in my book as well. I want to know categorically if you can, like when Nature Conservation said to me, they're busy making the law on thick skin game. Mm. What do you recommend? I said 100-pound bow and 1,000-grain arrow. They said, but you can't do that. Most people can't pull a 100-pound bow. So I said, well then tell them if they can't pull a 100-pound bow, they mustn't shoot the elephant.
Yeah.
But they said, no, they can't, most people can't work. But most people can if when you start shooting a bow, you pull the, you get the bow, you can hardly pull it. By the second week, you think, yes, look at this thing, it's like, check it up. By the third week, check it up. So, there is a limit when it starts getting really hard.
Mm.
But most strong young guys can pull a 100-pound bow if they put their mind to it. Just takes a bit of time.
Yeah.
You don't have to start on a 100-pound bow. You can start on a 60 and then a 70 and then a 80. And if you want it badly enough and the guy says you can only shoot an elephant with a 100, you'll get there.
Yeah.
Then you with your long draw length, you don't need a 100-pound bow. You just need an 80-pound bow.
Mm.
So that's changed a lot now.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about, you mentioned you're developing broadheads. Tell me more about the broadheads, the ones that you initially developed and then the ones that you...
So I developed one called the Dr. Death, that guy called, he started a company called Pathfinder Broadheads, and when I asked him if he'd make mine, I just forgot his name was Paul Zimmerman.
Okay.
And he had Zimmer Engineering in Durban, and he made my broadheads, the Dr. Death ones. And then they moved to New Zealand. And now he's too far away to make them for me because the shipping will be too expensive for us to buy them here.
Mm.
We've got to ship them from New Zealand. So now I've got another friend of mine who's making the new Dr. Deaths. But they're going to be similar but better than the Iron Will, but they're not going to weigh so much. They're going to be 250 and less.
250 grains
and less. So okay. We'll make a light one and a heavier one.
Okay, and they also screw in.
Did I not send you a picture of it? I'm sure
you did. You did, yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Yes, and it's going to be a replaceable blade.
There's going to be two of them. You can see them. I don't know if you'll see it on the camera.
I'll put a picture on the link for the interview. Yeah, cool. So
they're going to be super good broadheads.
So it's like a ferrule that you then screw onto the blade, and that blade is a replaceable blade, or is it a solid one?
You'll buy the broadhead like you buy that broadhead.
Like a solid.
Just screw it onto your arrow.
Just a solid broadhead, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's one other thing as well, like when I've been learning to walk and stalk hunt in like the Eastern Cape and other parts of South Africa, there's a lot of little details that are really important. One of them is about being quiet and understanding your terrain, but footwear is like an important thing. Having quiet shoes.
That's why I'm wearing these shoes. Others aren't boots like this.
Yeah.
They're on the stairs if you want to get them.
Yeah, I'll grab them.
And I sold those boots for many years, and then the company that was making them for me, the Grasshopper Company in Oudtshoorn, said that the colored guy who was stitching my boots for me, which are these boots, these shoes, but in a boot,
yes.
You see?
Yeah, I see.
So they said the colored guy that was making these boots for me got in an accident and he can't do it anymore. So there were no more boots like this. And then I found out that my friend Neil Massey got hold of them and convinced them to start making the boots again. So he started selling my boots.
Okay, so he still makes them now.
Yeah, and then he said that most South Africans have got very wide feet and they can't fit in these narrow shoes.
Yes.
So now he doesn't make these anymore either. He makes the ones like the wildebeest shoes.
You can still
buy these grasshoppers in Tacky Town.
Yes.
And just wear a gaiter on them to stop the grass seeds in your...
Yes.
So I'm always running in a pair, a new pair. You'll see I've got two pairs there.
Yeah.
This pair I cut away because it was hurting me somewhere, but it wasn't this that was hurting me. It was something else.
But
I just wear those gaiters always. And these boots. So these boots are years old, but they're still soft, 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 quiet. Now you must wear either a guinea suit, a leafy suit, face mask, gloves, UV protective shirt under your leafy suit so you don't get skin cancer, because you will in South Africa.
Mm.
I always cover my hands and my feet on my face. And then a leafy suit, and then one of those bags for all your toys. And carry as little as possible because it starts dragging around when you're crawling around in the bush.
Making noise.
And the leafy suit's got to be the worst design thing in the world for hooking. It hooks on every bloody thing. It's the most useless thing. But it works so well, you just have to persevere.
It's so true. And I have experienced that many times. And it's also because in South Africa, and I'm guessing other African countries, everything bites you, including the plants, right? There's so many thorns and hooky, everything is designed in a way.
Texas is the same.
Is it? Okay.
I designed jumpsuits, full-length leafy suits.
Okay.
As jumpsuits for winter, they're in the cupboard over there, for a sniper.
Okay.
And they said to me, oh, they're going to pay me. They never paid me a cent, but they did give me free camo.
Okay.
So,
well, at least you got something.
Yeah, so I used, in winter, I've got a half leafy suit even. So the one half looks different to the other half.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so I would never buy the pants. You don't need the leafy suit pants, because you can wear pants like this or the cute pants. Just the top's important, the pants aren't important.
Why?
Because your legs, the animals aren't looking for legs. They're looking for this shape.
Like the head and shoulders.
They want the square thing with the square thing on top.
Okay.
If you can have a wide brimmed hat like this, it's round, like my leafy hat there, it's like round, it's not square.
Yes. So it breaks up your outline.
Yeah.
Okay.
They don't want to see this square thing with the head on top.
I've kind of been making a few things to try and break up that with lots of leaves and stuff, and it seems to be working well.
If there's an animal there and you stand sideways, they don't see this shoulder with the head on, they see this thing with the head on.
And it just looks like a line.
Yeah, so they don't want to see the head on the shoulders.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay,
and so... you can carry a black umbrella with you, fold up one.
Yeah.
And you open that and they think it's an ostrich. It works very well.
Really?
I've always got a black umbrella in my pocket. I open it up. I used to have a camo one, but now when I see that I can't get closer by stalking, then I just walk with the black umbrella open. And then I don't try and hide. If you walk and then you're ducking and diving, they know you're up to something.
Yes.
But if you just walk slowly at an angle away from them, not at them, so if they're there, you just walk at the angle like this, like an ostrich, like that.
Yeah.
And I'll let you walk right past them like that.
Yes. So you made me think of a question, which I'd love to pick your brains about. This is more like a personal one for me. I've noticed something, like, so I recently was lucky enough to take a kudu and a duiker in a couple of days. Maybe 3 days.
The kudu was amazing, though. They're very hard to get.
Thank you. Yeah, I surprised myself. But the thing that's interesting is I feel like, and tell me if this sounds like bullshit, but in the way that you said, if you're moving and you're sneaking around or you start like moving that way, they know something's up. I approached those, both of those animals in a way that was very calm and not agitated in any way, at times. They would be briefly looking in my direction and they were aware of something.
But then you mustn't move.
I didn't ever move.
No.
So I never moved when anything was looking at me. But then the rest of the time, I moved actually relatively quickly. Like the duiker, I shot at 9 yards and it was 100 yards away. And it was almost like I walked up to it and I was just, but it was, I feel like it's about being very calm and just smooth and moving in a way that doesn't, not like I'm a predator trying to creep up on something, you know? It's almost like have you noticed that?
No, they don't
pick up on...
And you'll also notice if you wound something and you're busy looking for the wounded animal, the other animals will let you walk right past them.
Right, because you're not...
They can see that you're not interested, you're not actually hunting them.
Yes.
We had it when we shot a zebra. And we were trying to find the wounded one, and the other ones would just let us walk in between them. It was crazy.
That's so strange.
Because they knew we weren't after them anymore. Oh, it was weird.
It's so curious, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I worked on my farm, I used to run a lot, which I don't anymore. And in the afternoon, I'd go for like an hour run on my farm. And the animals, the same animals that would run away if they saw me walking.
Yes.
They wouldn't run away. I'd jog right past them. They'd carry on digging. Pigs would dig. The placebok would carry on eating. They wouldn't worry. But as soon as I was walking, then they would run away.
With like a camo outfit on.
They just know that their duck's not hunting. Just ignore him.
How funny.
Oh.
I was over in East London, and there's a farm in that kind of area, and it's a similar kind of thing where there's like the farmhouse is there and the animals are very tame around that farmhouse, and there's people working, jumping in and out of buckies trucks all the time, and they don't react at all. They could be 30 or 40 yards away, nice blessed ox or like zebra, impala, and they don't even bat an eyelid when you're there slamming doors back and forth. But as soon as you start walking towards them, like you've got that fire in your eyes, like you want to try and shoot one with a bow and arrow, foof, they're onto you, they're looking at you and they're gone.
Got a few minutes left.
Okay.
I'll just tell you a quick story. A friend of mine had a farm at Brits on the Crocodile River. So he had a lot of game on the farm. It was only 75 hectares, but it was long and thin on the river. So if you walk in the middle of the farm, you have a 50 meter shot to that fence or a 50 meter shot to the other fence. So then the farmer, his name was Dion Knussen, he's a urologist in Krugerdorp. He said, you can't leave the cows, don't you want to shoot the cows and eat, make biltong with them? So we bought the cows. When we came around the corner, on the day we were going to shoot the cows were gone. Gone, bro. Eventually they only managed to shoot them with a rifle. Those cows were impossible. Nobody had shot the cow there.
No one had shot at it, yeah.
But the day that we're walking between the cows to shoot the animal, the day that the farmer said, do you want to shoot the cow each? Well, they were bulls, but nice big fat ones. Gone, boy. Nobody shot one with a bow. They battled to shoot them with a rifle. I think they managed to shoot three out of the five.
That's crazy. So, we're going to wrap up very quickly, but I wanted to just ask a quick question, almost like, I guess, a two-parter, which is, if you're talking to people who are new to bow hunting in South Africa, Africa, or anywhere in general, if there were like one, two, or three important things to tell them to think about or how to approach...
I know exactly what to tell them. I say to them,
okay,
find the best dealer that's near where you live. The best dealer, of a most competent dealer, like Magnum Archery, for example.
Like a bow shop.
The best bow shop. And then decide if you're going to do it properly. Don't go there and buy a cheap, crappy bow and say, I'm going to try this bow and pick up a few arrows, and if I like it, I'll pursue it. Go there. Nowadays, everybody is buying really good bows every year, and the guys with lots of money, and I can name lots of them, they're dying for next year's bow, and they get rid of last year's bow, and then there's a phenomenal bow, but it's 2 years old, and it's going for less than half price.
Yeah.
With all the toys on, buy a top quality old bow. If you can't afford to buy a brand new bow.
Mm.
I mean, my 2017, this bow, yeah, it's 2017. I'm still shooting it today and I won't shoot another bow. Yeah. I don't need another bow.
Yeah.
Those bows now are going for $7,000 brand new.
Mm.
The option 6, £80. You can 90% let off if you want to.
Mm.
You buy that bow, you'll never have to buy another bow again. You can shoot an elephant with that bow. So that's my suggestion.
That's your suggestion, like in terms of equipment.
And then shoot lots of 3D competitions, because those will make you shoot in the correct place on the animals.
Mm.
And I love doing it as well. I'm not particularly good at it, surprisingly enough. So I can shoot animals, but I'm not good on targets.
It's better if they have a pulse. Doc,
that's it.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
There's one, the last question, which is more of like a admin question, which is like, how, if people want to pick your big brain about hunting, or if they want to say hi or tell you a story or anything like that, is there a way to reach you?
They can email me.
Okay, how do they do that? What's your email address?
The sirc@archon.co.za, the one you use.
Okay, yeah, I will put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
And then also, if people want to buy your books, of which you have four.
They can do it the same way.
Okay, just send you an email. Okay. And tell me the titles of the books and maybe a quick outline of what each of them is about. Can you do that?
Well, Stay sitting there.
Okay.
I'll just give you the one that you're missing.
Yeah, the missing piece of the puzzle, which is the first book, I think, right?
Yeah, so the first book. This one was sold out in no time. This is the third reprint. This is the one they will get 3 days later in there. Yeah, it's a present.
Amazing. Thank you. Thank you very much. I look forward to reading this.
Original mistakes in it.
That's all part of the character.
Yeah.
So is it sold out right now? So it's not available?
It's not sold out. I've got new ones.
You've got new copies. Okay, yeah. So if you're interested, this one is the first one, Bow Hunting in Southern Africa. And then the next one?
The next one is Whatever It Takes.
Okay.
And then The Way I See It.
Yep.
And Bow Hunting Dangerous Game.
Okay. And so if you're interested in any of those books, send an email to the email in the show notes, and the doc will get back to you and let you know the details.
Is that a black pen?
This is a black pen, yeah.
And we're writing it for you.
Yeah, please do.
There you go.
Amazing. Thank you.
A pleasure. I hope your video comes out well.
Oh, it will, I'm certain. No, fantastic. And yeah, so hopefully at some point, if I think of some other questions, I'd love to pick your brains again in the future.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Okay.
You can WhatsApp me.
All right, well, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Right, that wraps up another episode. A big thank you again to Dr. Adrian de Villiers. Unfortunately, you can't follow his adventures on Instagram, but you can read his books or send him an email to sarc@icon.co.za, and I'm sure he'll happily tell you the latest adventure that he's been up to, and maybe even offer you a bit of advice. If you enjoyed this episode, then it would be amazing if you could show your support by sharing it with a friend, or by sharing a 5-star review with the rest of the world. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. Until next time.